Hi, I'm Jillian Swinford.
And I'm Haley Brolison.
And this is Mother Nature Will Kill You,
a podcast about the most horrific tragedies
and the most triumphant survival stories that the wilderness can provide.
So grab your backpack
and maybe a bottle of wine
and let's go on a wild ride into the unknown.
Walking down this road I go, but I am going alone, running far, far from home till I skin and bone. I don't want to die, but I'll have to try. I don't want to die, but I'm on my own. Hello, everybody.
Good afternoon.
Good evening. Good night. Good morning.
Good morning, whatever it is.
We just had half of our usual 20-minute pre-story chat off air because, you know, there's just some things going on in the job situation that are maybe coming to fruition, maybe not. So, you know,
we just need to keep some secrets is all.
Yeah, we just needed some zippy zips.
Yeah.
But other than that, the funny thing is this episode comes out after your wedding.
It does, but yeah. So right now I'm still a single, well, not single lady, but, you know, I'm an unmarried woman.
An unwed woman.
What was that? Did I send you this meme? I know I sent it to my friend Liz, and it was about like unmarried women sitting around gossiping, and there's like a term for it. And I think it was called like muffin walloper or something.
No, you didn't send that to
me. Oh my God. I sent it to her. Let me go find it real quick because it was really funny. She's like, can we please refer to each other as like this term? And I was like, yeah.
Yeah.
In Victorian slang, a muffin walloper was an unmarried woman who enjoyed meeting up with her friends to gossip over tea and cakes.
That sounds like a great time.
Sounds like
though.
A great time to meet you.
I'm totally down with being a muffin walloper, but I have value because I'm married.
Yeah.
I have value as a woman because I found a man.
Yeah. You belong to somebody now.
I do. Yeah, that's how that worked out. Totally.
Yeah.
That's how that whole relationship goes.
Meanwhile, Corey is saved in my phone as Corey Swinford.
Yeah. Yeah. Obviously. But yeah, so it's, we're not quite a week out, but I am
10 days.
Yeah, I'm a week out from like leaving for the Keys.
Yeah, that's so exciting.
I know, I'm
super
excited.
Super exciting. I know, yeah. I am like a few days out from taking leave for the wedding. So I was looking at my time off today because I have like 9 days of vacation built up, which is awesome. So I'm going to use all of them.
Do it.
A lot of time off, which is
a long time off. Yeah, I took 2 weeks off for mine, but I was also like flying to Virginia to do mine.
Yeah.
And we had like international people coming. And so like we stayed later so that we could see them. But all we were doing was just like going back and forth between the houses. And it was so exhausting.
Yeah. It's going to be a lot. Like we have an after hours event on Tuesday. So like that's why I'm like kind of doing more hours there. Cause I'm like, I'll help with that, but I'm really just trying because my parents come in on Sunday, Alex's parents come in on Monday. So like I kind of want to have that time off when people start coming in.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'll do like half day on Monday and Tuesday, and then Wednesday to Friday, like Wednesday to like April 1st Friday or whatever, or that's Monday, but March 29th Friday is like all vacation. Which is so nice. I'm so excited.
So that's like, I'm so happy for you. It's going to be, we're going to have a blast. Also,
I know. Like, it'll be fun.
Yeah.
It'll be so fun. My friend Nikki got married the weekend of March 1st. And I'm going to try to show you this photo that she sent to us today because it's hilarious. She had giant Jenga at her reception. And like, it got really tall. And it was one of those things where like, it was going to fall over no matter what. And the photographer was right there. And I looked up and like, she was snapping photos. And I was like, oh, that is about to be the funniest photo ever. And like, look at
Is that
like,
you?
that is me. Like,
That's so good. You look terrified.
I know. And like, Jesse's just like laughing, like, ah, yeah, like, it, like, is hilarious.
That's so funny. Was
And
that the one in Savannah?
yeah, that was the one in Savannah.
Oh my God.
And Nikki's like, this might be my favorite photo. And I
So
like,
good. That's a good
and
wedding photographer getting those
yeah,
candid shots.
yes. And Emily goes, this is my next Christmas card. And she just like got the sticker from like that photo. And then Nikki's like, should we make pictures for Haley's wedding? Just kidding. I wouldn't do that to you, Haley. And I was like, dude, if you did, like everyone would think it's hilarious. Like Alex's family is so fun and sarcastic. Like I'm sure they would make a lot of jokes about it. And then I started to make jokes about it, like quoting them as if they like what they would say. And it's like, this looks like Haley the first time she met us. Oh, I bet this ma she makes this face a lot living with Alex, like stuff like that. I'm like, they would think that's hilarious. There's just like those stickers around. But
Oh
yeah,
my gosh.
that was fun.
I'm so excited. Oh, I do have a question though, because there's
Oh yeah.
been like the fish whole fish toxin thing. Are people still getting in the water?
Dude. I mean, if we want to make that like our intro to our podcast, yes, I will
Sure.
give a little bit of an update on that. So, everybody that's listening to like the three people that are listening to this, there has been a lot of what they're calling quote unquote spinning fish in the lower keys. And then just recently I heard that there is spinning fish documented up in Largo Sound. And then like I saw that there was another observation in like Duck Key. So it's starting to like move up the keys. And before it was just kind of concentrated in the lower keys, like Big Pine to Key West. And like when I say spinning fish, it's like, you know, they're literally like upside down in circles. Like they're just erratic behavior.
Like they lose equilibrium and
Yeah, and it's really weird because, like, you know, being in the environmental field, we have like other friends in the environmental field just for different organizations as well. And one of them brought up a good point. They were like, you know, we've seen them spinning, but like we actually haven't seen them die as they're spinning. So like, what's actually happening? Like, are they just having a seizure and then they swim off and they're fine? Or like, are they dying? And is like a larger fish eating them before we can actually see that there's a fish kill happening. So
Yeah,
it's like a
or
go
while they're
ahead.
spinning, are they being predated on because they're vulnerable? Because
Yeah.
that's kind of what happens with like the shrimp black gill is that their metabolism tanks. And so they physically get sick. They can't move as fast, and get away from predators as fast. And so
Yeah.
that's where we think a lot of the mortality is happening in that disease. So
Oh, that's interesting.
could
Yeah,
be
it could be
something like
like
that.
something like that too. Yeah, so it's a really weird phenomenon because like there's not a lot of dead fish floating around, but yet we're seeing a lot of like weird behavior. And then the sawfish are dying. That's like the one fish that's actually like dying. And that's an issue because there's like 250 left of them in the world and they're all kind of concentrated down in South Florida. And just within the last month, 20 have died. I think it's like 21 have died. And so, from what I've heard through the grapevine on that, or what we call down here the Coconut Telegraph, it appears that they're nearly all females that have died, which is also kind of interesting. But I don't really know what's really going on with the sawfish. They're taking tissue samples and water quality samples. And when I say they, I mean like all of the scientists that work in the conservation field down here. Like there's, you know, the state biologists, there's nonprofit biologists, like everybody is, there's federal biologists are on it too. Like everybody's working really hard to figure out what's going on. because it is really frightening. And people are asking the question, like, can I eat that grouper sandwich? Can I eat like shellfish? Can I get in the water? Like, what's happening to the fish? Like, am I okay to get in the water? And what they've found so far is nothing. So like as far as like the data shows, like, yeah, you can go in the water, like, yeah, you can eat that fish sandwich, but like me personally, like, I would probably err on the side of caution. Like, I don't know what's going on. Like, I'll stay away from seafood. Ironically, I had fish tacos this past weekend. So, you know what I mean? I'm like, I'm right there with them when they're like concerned, but then I'm also like, ah, I'm hungry. Fish tacos sound good. I'm gonna get some fish tacos and see what
Yeah, so that's
happens.
the thing, because I'm like, I really want to get grouper from El Saboni. I feel like the grouper, they catch them like offshore. Is this off happening offshore too, or is it just near
No,
shore?
it's just backcountry. It's like inshore, like bait fish is like kind of how it started. And now it's like
Interesting.
stingrays and like the sawfish are beaching themselves. And then like there's like people have showed videos of like snook. Some people say like tarpon are being affected. So, you know, like it's all sorts of fish right now, it seems like, but it's all
Near
inshore.
shore. Okay. So that might be a good thing to tell people if you're going to eat seafood, eat offshore seafood.
Yeah, and that's kind of what Alex said too, because I think I said to you recently how I had a stress dream about how like our wedding's on Palm Sunday, and like, you know, as Catholics, you can't eat meat on Friday, and then like you can't eat meat on Ash Wednesday. So then I was like, oh fuck, we meet on Palm Sunday, we have no fish option for our people, like it's all fucking meat, like what are we gonna do, you know? And he was like, no, like it's fine. And he's like, and also like, you know, and then I said something about like, oh, well, maybe it's a good thing we don't have a fish option, because like who would want to eat fish right now anyway? And he was like, well, that's all like inshore fish. Like the fish that you eat, like that they would cater is like, you know, mahi and stuff like that, or like they're getting it offshore, which is, you know, fine. So,
Well, and you can always still eat shellfish and conch,
Yes, you can. Yeah, so it's like it's a really weird thing that's happening. It's kind of honestly really scary. There's like a couple theories out there, but like nothing's actually been proven. And one of the captains for the state law enforcement has been on all of the local Facebook pages, like giving an update, like, let's not get frenetic about it. You know, like we're still doing research, people are working on it. Like, you know, we're gonna update everybody as, you know, things come in, and this is what we've found so far. And you know, like when they're looking for a certain toxin in these tissue samples, like they're looking for an outlier, and all of the levels of whatever components they're testing for in these tissue samples, they're all normal, within the same range. Like there's nothing that's like glaring at them. So that's kind of hard to determine.
I wonder if
And
it's like an unidentified pathogen.
yeah, I don't know. Or like, is it like an unidentified parasite? Like who knows what's happening? And like, yeah, so like there's none of those like levels are really glaring at them for them to like have an answer for that. And then also, you know, in Florida there's red tides. I'm sure, I think you guys probably get red tides over in Texas of from time to time too. Yeah. And so like, so you know, people were talking about like, you know, oh, is there any of like the Karenia brevis, that red tide algae strain in the water? And the answer is no. It's not like not at bloom levels, you know.
Well,
So
it's
like
not red tide season either, like at
it's
all.
no. And so like that's the other thing. It's like, you know, there's no Karenia brevis in the water. So like the water quality tests aren't showing anything. The tissue samples aren't showing anything. So it's like a really big like head scratcher, like what the fuck is happening down here? And so another one of the theories is like the Ciguatera toxin. And so, and I don't know enough about it, but what my simple brain has kind of processed and the few things that I've read is that corals and seagrasses tend to uptake that toxin. So then the fish community doesn't intake it as much. And like it kind of shares that load. And you know, last summer we had a really hot summer and a lot of our corals died. And we also have a seagrass bed issue down here as well. So like putting all that together, I was like, oh, does this mean that like we're having like with the scarce amount of tissue cover for coral on the reef, does that mean that like we're at a point where like There's literally not enough tissue cover to uptake this toxin to share the load, so the fish community doesn't get it to a point where they're being harmed by it. But then again, the tissue samples would show that toxin. You know what I mean? And it's not. So that's what's weird.
Yeah, that is very.
Okay.
I'm looking at the species right now, and it is seems to be all inshore stuff.
Yeah.
But like things like Goliath grouper are getting it, I'm assuming,
Like
as
juveniles are inshore.
juveniles inshore. Yeah. I don't know. I'll let you know if I see any, I guess, while I'm out snorkeling and diving and
Yeah,
stuff.
there's tons of like report numbers to call, like the FWC
Yeah.
hotlines and stuff like that. So, I mean, everybody's like really concerned about it. One of the dogs that I watched during the weekday, her owner is a Lower Keys guide, and he was saying that like he was worried because the permit hadn't come back yet, and that was probably about a month ago. And I heard recently that the permit came back, so that's at least like a good sign. But yeah, it's a weird thing that's going on down here right now, and it's a little scary. So yeah. So yeah, you can get in the water for sure. Like there's no answer to what's happening, and like I don't know, like the organization I work for, like they have divers that were just in the water. They're in the water all the time and they seem fine, you know. But it is terrifying to
A little
see.
alarming. So, yeah, I got it's actually made it all the way to Texas, Fish and Game magazine. Strange
Oh,
spinning
wow.
fish phenomenon strikes Florida. So, if you want to read more about that, I'm sure there's some Floridian news articles about it as well, but
Yeah.
that's.
So when I was at the seafood festival over the weekend, Florida Fish and Wildlife's research station that's in St. Pete was down here, and I talked to them about what they're finding because they're the ones that are processing all of those tissue samples. And so from what I gathered, it sounds like they're thinking it's like an algal bloom of sorts, but just like an algal bloom that like we're not accustomed to, and they're still trying to figure out exactly what that algae is. But ironically, that's like that out I'm fairly certain, I'm gonna Google it real quick, but that Ciguatera toxin comes from an algae bloom. So
That's what I was saying on that article.
yeah, so it's like if they're like, oh, it's an algal bloom, then is that what you're like, is that, are you saying that it's Ciguatera then? Like, what does that mean? It's the marine microalgae called Gamberdiscus toxicus. So yeah, Gamberdiscus is the algal bloom, I guess, and then Ciguatera is the illness, the poisoning that comes from that algal bloom.
Well, I'll try not to get it in my gills, I guess.
Yeah, you little
I
mermaid, you.
am. I'm kind of annoying. I told Corey, I was
I
like,
know.
you basically have a free day, the day of the wedding. Like, go do whatever you want to do. Please don't stay at the hotel on your switch the whole time. He was like,
Yeah.
don't tell me what to do on my vacation. I was like, well, because if it was me, I would go snorkeling and then I would go shopping. Like, I
Yeah.
would be taking advantage. Just
Yeah.
saying.
He can do it every once.
He can and he will,
I
but I'm
know. It's
like,
nice that he's close to one of the trolley stops.
is he?
Yeah,
Yeah, you'll
he's
have to
like,
send me
I will. Yeah, I
back
was
when
just
we're
working
done.
on that.
If you
It'll
ever,
be
that's
fun.
one road trip in the US that I recommend to people, is doing US 1, like from
Yeah.
Miami to Key West. That's probably one of my favorite road trips that
I put
I've
that on our
done.
wedding website when I was like, there's two airports you can fly into. You can fly into Miami or you can fly into Key West. Like, if you want to see the Keys in their entirety, fly into Miami and drive through all of them, you know?
Well, I think because
So.
you live there, you're just like so used to it, but it is such a beautiful, like amazingly beautiful drive, you know?
Yeah, it is really pretty. And like, you know, there most of the time I probably do get a little used to it, but you know, there's days like today where I was driving into the lab and I'm like, you know, going over Pine Channel and I'm like, this is just just so nice that I live here. You know, like
Mm Yeah.
it's just pretty all the time. There's all this water around, you know, like, yeah, I like it. I definitely like where I live. I'm
Yeah.
not complaining at all.
That's good. I wish I could say
Yeah. And
the
like flying into Key West is really pretty 'cause like you start seeing like all of the islands. Like
Yeah.
flying into the Keys, like I literally can see my house from the airplane. Like
That's
'cause you
so
can
funny. Yeah.
yes, like you there 'cause we're low enough 'cause it's starting to like, you know, hit that descent and then like you can see like the little neighborhoods on each
That's so
key and I'm
funny.
like that's my neighborhood and that's my house over there.
I'm
Yeah.
excited to fly it because I've never flown into the Keys before, so I'm excited for that.
It's really pretty and like that looking out the window for that like that doesn't get old to me like leaving or coming in from Key West like yeah that's
Yeah.
like my
It's kind of
favorite.
mad. You gotta like take in, even when you get used to a place, you gotta take in those little magical things.
Yeah.
I do it
So.
here in Texas, even though I think the part of the state that I live in is pretty fucking ugly. But in the spring, Texas is just so beautiful. Like all the wildflowers are in bloom. The weather is amazing. But then in the back of your mind, you're like, but summer is
Summer's about to
coming.
be here.
Yeah, so we should probably start talking about our story,
Yes, I agree. We've spent an absurd amount of time.
We gotta do it though. It's like a ritual at this point. It's a
Yes,
ritual.
it is.
So this story is gonna be a bummer.
Oh, okay. That's
I'm
cool.
sorry.
That's fine.
The last one I thought was, it was good. It was interesting. It's not about anybody we know, but this one is like
We know these
really.
people?
No. I'm just talking about
Oh.
like, I mean, prehistoric people. I feel like we're so far
Oh,
removed from them,
okay. I was like, what are you setting me
I'm
up for right now?
gonna tell you about how all these people. This story is pretty heavy, but I think it is something we haven't talked about yet, as far as like a natural disaster.
I'm seeing a lot of fire links.
Yeah, so we're going to talk about wildfires today, and probably one of the biggest in recent history wildfire disasters, as far as like from a death and emergency personnel standpoint.
Yeah.
And this happened in 2013. So about 10 years ago, but still pretty modern compared to some of the stories we tell
Yeah.
on the podcast. And I think there's a lot of modern day wildfire stories because it's becoming more of a problem,
It is. Yeah.
because the West is drying out, and that leads to fire. And we'll kind of get into that, a little bit about like the science behind that climate, change that is
Can
going on.
I tell a funny quick story about
Sure.
wildfires? So, part of preventing wildfires is having prescribed burns. And a prescribed burn is usually conducted by professionals within a wildlife organization, such as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife. I live in front of refuge property that they maintain by having prescribed burns. There's a guy down the street that is like super freaking crazy geezy guy. And kept trying to dump water on the prescribed burn that they were starting. And they, long story short, they ended up arresting him because it's a federal offense. Like you're
Yeah.
like getting, you're causing, you know, what is it? Like, it's not like what is it? It's not, it's obstruction. Yeah.
Obstruction of fire.
Like it's like a federal obstruction for like conservation or something like that. Yeah, so they ended up arresting him. And then Alex was there for that. And one day Alex and I are at the Winn-Dixie up the street and we're going to buy some scratchers at the counter. And that fucking guy that was arrested, that Alex arrested, was at the counter in front of us And Alex like turned his head because the guy like turned and like looked at Alex, and Alex like was starting to act really weird. And after that guy walked away, Alex turned around to me and he was like, "That was the guy that we arrested for trying to put out the wildfire on the prescriber." And
Oh,
he was like, "I was really hoping he wasn't gonna recognize me in public."
he did.
Yeah. So yeah, I mean, hot tip to anybody that's out there, don't fucking like get in the middle of a conservation effort, because depending on the organization that's hosting it, you could be arrested for a federal offense.
Yeah, and we'll get into why actually doing prescribed burns it helps prevent wildfires, because that kind of is counterintuitive.
It sounds,
But
yeah, counterintuitive,
yeah,
but
it does. But there's some very good reasons for why that is, mainly because it gets rid of potential fuel in the
that,
form
and then
of
there's
brush,
also,
dry brush.
yeah, and then there's also some species of trees and other plants that their seeds need fire to open their seed pods and then, continue on their life cycle. So there's also
Yeah,
that.
it's like how hurricanes do the same thing for habitats in, the southeastern United States, but they also do a whole lot of damage to houses. So,
Yeah,
yeah.
it's a lot.
So let's get into the story. So we're going to Arizona, which makes so much sense.
Oh yeah, that's dry,
Yeah,
dry.
crispy. It was fire season in Arizona on June 28th, 2013, in the small mountain community of Yarnell, about 80 miles northwest of Phoenix. Lightning from a dry thunderstorm ignited the Yarnell Hill fire on the ridge west of Yarnell on June 28th. Extreme drought had been affecting the area for months, with the second worst drought category according to the U.S. Drought Monitor, which I have that map shown below. I believe U.S. Fish and Wildlife or NOAA is the one that monitors that,
Okay.
the drought levels, basically. So during a low pressure system moving over the area, thunderstorms developed on the morning of June 28th. But because the atmosphere was so dry, the rain evaporated before even touching the ground. These are called dry thunderstorms.
Oh.
But they bring lightning with them, which is a fire starter.
Do you think that during these dry thunderstorms, like you can see the rain happening, but like you also see it not falling all the way?
Yeah.
So it's like half raining. That's weird. That's weird, but I bet that's kind of cool to see too.
Yeah, but like when you need rain and you're seeing that happen, that must be like so infuriating.
Yeah, you're like, just come a little further, please.
Yeah. So shortly after lightning struck the ridge, a wildfire was ignited. This fire fell under the Arizona State Forestry Division, and the area had not experienced a wildfire in over 45 years.
Oh wow, that's
And
been a long time for them,
I
huh?
know. And that area was primed to burn because of extreme drought, decadent chaparral, which I found out meant dry brushland
Oh,
habitat,
okay.
and then above average cured grass loadings, which means that there was a lot of dry grass fuel lying around.
Yeah.
Basically, Yarnell was situated in a bad place for the present conditions, as it's surrounded by hills with dry brush and scrub oak, with temperatures that summer well over 100 degrees. So, just like the perfect storm, basically. So, since the fire started on a ridge, it was able to sweep down quickly with the wind. On June 29th, winds increased and the fire was spotted outside of containment lines. The incident commander ordered a Type 2 incident management team for the following morning, and the fire grew overnight from 300 to 500 acres in size.
God.
Yarnell resident Jerry Floman described the day. We could see fire up in the hills, and that was pretty startling to see the tops of the mountains behind our home on fire. I was not packing for sentimentality. I was packing, What do I want to start a new life with if I have to? Her house ultimately burnt down in the fire. Members of the Type 2 team arrived early on June 30th, including the Granite Mountain Hotshot team, who is going to be the main focus of our story today.
Alrighty.
So, what the hell is a hotshot team?
Yeah. What is that?
So they're actually really freaking cool. Granite Mountain Hotshots, or the Granite Mountain Interagency Hotshot Crew, is a team of wildland firefighters from the Prescott, Arizona Fire Department. The crew was started in 2022 as a fuels mitigation crew, but transitioned to a hand crew in 2004, and ultimately a hotshot crew in 2008. So hotshots are like the best of the best when it comes to like wildland firefighting.
Okay.
They get put into kind of like the worst
Worst case
circumstances.
scenarios, yeah.
Yeah. In 2013, the team consisted of 20 men. Hotshot crews are nationally available, intensively trained 20-person hand crews of elite wildland firefighters. They are the best trained and in the finest condition. The crew was led by Eric Marsh, known as Papa, a quiet, wry man who had been fighting fires for 2 decades. A man who referred to the 19 young men on his crew as his kids. And I think Eric was in his 40s. So they're all pretty young,
Yeah.
like young kids. Squad leaders included a 23-year-old Robert Cadwell, Sol team squad boss Travis Carter, and Clayton Whitted, rounded out by 36-year-old second in command Captain Jesse Steed.
They look like such a fun bunch.
Yeah. Their main task is to go into areas on foot with 40 to 50 pounds of gear, carrying shovels and chainsaws, creating fire lines to protect areas from damage. They carry food and water to stay out in the wilderness for days, wearing fireproof suits and carrying individual fire shelters on their backs in backpacks. And I have an example of what a fire shelter is. They're basically kind of like very small tinfoil tents that can
Yeah, like
basically just
space
cover up
bags.
body.
Looks like space bags.
Yeah. They're made with like fire retardant and resistant material designed to protect a human body from flames. But unfortunately, the shelters only work for a short time, if the fire is moving quickly through an area. And firefighters can only survive temperatures of around 300 degrees Fahrenheit in these.
Oh, wow.
This will come back later.
Okay.
Fire shelters have saved lives in the past, but living through a fire in one can only be described as an absolute hellish experience that most firefighters basically hope that they're unconscious during, that they don't experience it, because you can still get burned,
Yeah.
and experience like very high temperatures.
Ugh.
The Granite Mountain Hotshots were working other fires in Arizona and New Mexico when the newest fire broke out in Yarnell. And so they were brought from that to come move to this because it was getting pretty serious pretty quickly. So let's talk a little bit about like what it takes to fight a wildland fire, because I've been talking about like creating fire lines and shit. Didn't know what that meant until I like started reading into it. So during summer and fall, there can be more than 100 wildfires burning around the US at any given time. Wildland firefighting takes very different techniques than regular firefighting. Creating fire lines is the main task of any hotshot team. Basically, what this means is you're separating the fire from the fuel that it's burning. So you basically create dirt paths in between like the fire and the fuel. So it's literally a dirt line that you're drawing in the ground.
Our hiking trails around here are called fire breaks,
Exactly,
and
exactly that.
that's exactly what they are. They're
Yeah.
breaks for the fire to not go.
So the primary source of fuel for fire are not trees, but actually dead brush and leaves on the forest floor. So creating fire lines requires people and bulldozers on the ground working nonstop. To stop the spread of the flames by removing fuel, creating swaths of bare ground between fire and potential fuel. Often this is done with simple tools like hand axes, shovels, for hours upon hours. This is all you're doing all day. Containing fires entirely can take days or even months, requiring daily plans and scouting. Most of the time, hotshot team priority is slowing the fire down until backup teams can come in and assist. So, some more facts about wildfires and how dangerous they can be. The change in the winds can make the fire spread more quickly. So, wildland firefighters need to always know where their escape routes are. Fire can move up to 7 mile per hour in forests, which is faster than humans can move in dense tree cover. Fires in grasslands can move even faster, up to 14 miles per hour.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Fire spreads most rapidly during 10 a.m. and sunset due to wind increasing and heat increasing. So, wildland firefighters will usually not place themselves directly in front of the fire, but will flank it and use roads like those fire breaks and boundaries, as fire often cannot cross the roads due to the lack of fuel. Streams can also serve this purpose. However, if wind increases, it can push embers beyond the roads and ignite fuel on the other side. So that's how so sometimes those things don't always work. Water can be used when fire has more vegetation to use as fuel, but getting fire trucks or vehicles up mountains can be difficult. So often using chainsaws to remove dead or burning trees can also be a method to contain fire. If a dry or dead standing tree is burning, they're often cut down, doused in water, and cut apart away from the fire line. Helicopter spraying water can also be used, but considering the size that wildland fires can get, they can really only be directed to like specific areas to subdue flames and can't necessarily put out a whole wildfire because these things are burning for like acres and acres and acres. Airplane and helicopter use must be prioritized for the most dangerous fires. Water or flame retardant can be used to quench flames, but both have different benefits and problems. Water is cheap and can be reloaded near the fire without landing, but it's only effective at extinguishing the flames. Fire retardant can prevent fire from spreading or starting, as well as extinguishing. And can be used to create a fire line, but it has to be loaded at an airport and is more expensive. So I just assumed that you could like take a helicopter out and just, spray a bunch of water and, I've never
It's
really looked
done.
into it.
Like,
So
why don't we just put a bunch of water on top of it?
yeah. 'Cause like I don't really have a whole lot of experience with like wildfires. Like I do remember when we moved to Colorado, there were major wildfires going on, and I actually had really bad allergies because of the smoke that was in the air all the time. But I haven't lived out west a whole lot, so I haven't really ever looked into like what it takes to actually fight one of these things. Yeah.
And they don't, did you say it already? They don't actually put water on it. It's like some sort of like powder that like they like drop on it. Is like really what it is?
Yeah. The like flame retardant or whatever. Yeah. So ultimately, the main goal of wildland firefighting is to control the flames, not to subdue it entirely. Flames or and fires are actually beneficial to forests and grassland habitats as it allows new seedlings to grow without competition and can increase diversity in the habitat following a fire. In addition, some seeds require fire to sprout and remain dormant until a wildfire happens. These are called like perturbation habitats where like
Say that again, perturbation.
perturbation, I might be making this up.
Perturbation.
Yeah, perturbation.
Can you spell it? Because I
Basically, they
can't understand.
require something like a fire or a hurricane in order for the ecosystem to remain healthy because it removes some of the competition.
What's the first letter you're saying in that? Is it a
P.
P? Okay. I couldn't tell if it was a P or an H. That's why I was like, is it a herbidation or perturbation?
It's habitat perturbation.
Okay. When I tried to Google it, it came up with prohibition. So clearly I'm spelling it wrong.
We all know where Google's mind is at today.
And then perdition, eternal damnation, aka hell. So that's another one that just popped up.
Perturbation is basically a disturbance.
Okay.
Yeah. Oh, and so also some trees also have fire resistant bark. So like older
True.
trees can withstand these wildfires. What makes wildfires worse is that we've started putting them out and allowing for dead and dry fuel to build up, making the fires that do happen more difficult to contain. And so that's how why all of these wildfires are just getting crazy out of control. In addition, climate change resulting in hotter and drier summers is only making this problem worse. Controlled burns are often prescribed to reduce the availability of fuel during fire season, like we said earlier, but this practice really didn't start to happen until like recent decades. And like the whole like smoky campaign really kind of screwed the whole natural like fire perturbation in habitats, because it made everybody think that like all wildfires are bad, basically, you know. So,
But like you don't want to start a wildfire because you
yeah,
smoke a
and so that's the
cigarette butt.
thing. Yeah,
Like
but for a while, on like our policy on wildfires was to like stop all of them, basically.
yeah.
We didn't
When we
realize until biologists did research on these habitats that they actually need fire.
had the prescribed burn a couple months ago, like one, it smelled like a bonfire for like a week straight, which was
Oh
like
yeah.
kind of really nice. But then also it's kind of funny because like, then the trees are like orangish brown and it's like, oh, it's like fall here, but it's like, no, those are like dead leaves. So it's like perpetually fall looking on that side of the road. But then also, like I was telling Alex, I was like, you can actually see through the woods now. Like, there's a bunch of key deer around, and I'm like, oh my God, like, I can actually see when one's back there, and I'm not gonna freak out if one jumps out in the road while I'm driving, because I can actually, like, see it back there. And it's like, it kind of feels nice. It made me feel a little bit safer, too. Like, if there's any, like, bum that's, like, walking in the woods, too, at night, it's like, I can actually see, like, I don't know, I can actually see through the woods, which it was nice. It really did clear up a lot of, like, the underbrush.
So back at the Yarnell Hill fire, which is quickly getting out of control and threatening the small mountain towns, members of the Type 2 team arrived early on June 30th. Including the Granite Mountain Hotshot team. The fire spread to the north and east for most of the day. But around 3:30 p.m., the wind shifted and the fire started pushing aggressively to the southeast toward Yarnell. Air temperature was at 100 degrees Fahrenheit and humidity was just at 10%. I don't even know what that's like. Oh God, that's gonna be so dry. And then the wind was at 16 miles per hour, increasing to 22 miles per hour by 2:30. And then by 3:30, wind gusts were reaching 44 miles per hour, which is
That's
not
crazy.
great. Fire resources were shifted to evacuate Yarnell residents and protect the structure of the town, with only the Granite Mountain Hotshots remaining out on the ridge. One member of the team, Brendan McDonough, which he is called Donut, that's his nickname, had separated from the team and was serving as a lookout at the time. The rest of the Granite Mountain Hotshots were still up on the ridge, watching the fire begin to change direction. And they have like phone records of this, but they were casually texting their loved ones while they had service, just chatting about stuff. They weren't concerned, because they were in a safe spot. But the whole situation broke down, partially due to a lack of communication. The personnel who had been communicating with the Granite Mountain Hotshots assumed that the crew would remain in what they call the black, which is an area of already burned fuel, which is obviously safer for firefighters, because there's nothing for the fire to eat at. At 16:30 or 4:30, a thunderstorm had reached the southern perimeter of the fire, one of those dry thunderstorms, increasing the wind substantially, causing the fire to turn directly south toward the Granite Mountain hotshots. The outflow boundary of the storm, or where the thunderstorm's cool air rushes out and away from the storm, was right over the fire, just adding wind and oxygen into the mix. Which, if you know anything about fire, you know that the more oxygen fire gets, the stronger it actually gets. Because the wind was shifting, the commander, Eric Marsh, had a choice to make: either stay in the black or try to move towards Yarnell and try to cut off the fire and try to make a difference for these people down in the town. Hotshots are the best of the best. They aren't very good at sitting idly by and watching houses get burned, potentially people dying. They are trained to help however they can, but it still would have been a very difficult decision to make. Meanwhile, Brendan McDonough, serving as the lookout, was watching the advancing wall of flames move toward him, understanding that he himself had no choice but to find an area without lots of fuel and deploy his fire shelter. So that the little tinfoil sleeping bag. At the last second, a firefighter on a four-wheeler came and picked him up and rushed him away from the danger.
Oh wow.
His
That's, I
crew
just
on
got
the
the
ridge
chills.
line basically watched the whole rescue.
Oh my gosh.
But like he knew that he could not outrun that fire, so he was like,
Yeah.
I
Hunker
gotta stop.
down.
Yeah. Yarnell Fire Chief Ben Palm states of the fire at the time: storm clouds came in, and when the column collapsed, there was no way you could outrun that. One of the guys describes from an airplane above that when it hit the canyon and came out, there was about a 40-foot flame.
Oh my God.
So this thing is getting really hot, really big, really intense, very fast. And it's all happening very quickly. These 40 to 45 mile per hour winds change the intensity and the direction of the fire spread, basically eliminating the crew's options of reaching the safety zone or returning to the ridge. So they had made the decision to try to go to Yarnell and try to kind of cut off this fire. But now this fire is moving so quickly that it's cutting off their chance of returning to the ridge.
Oh, that's scary.
This is called a flashover fire because it spreads through fuel and over ground so fast, consuming brush and trees extremely quickly. It was around this time that Brendan Donut or Donut was rescued, that Eric Marsh radioed down that the Granite Mountain team was moving back towards Yarnell. The team quickly covered a mile of the trail back to Yarnell and was realizing the smoke was becoming thicker. At this time, they had lost sight of the fire, which was hidden behind a smaller ridge blocking their view of the fire.
Ugh, I don't like
Eric would have
this.
had two options: either bail up the far side of the ridge to their right towards the questionable safety of the desert, 2,000 feet below them, or try to head to a more defensible space surrounding a ranch house, which was not far, a 15-minute hike in total. He radioed their intent to the plane circling overhead that they were going to go for the ranch house.
Oh my gosh.
As they descended into the basin towards the house, surrounded on three sides by boulders, so they're basically in like a, not a canyon, but like a little valley collar. I don't know. So they begin to see the flames from behind the ridge on their left. The winds push the fire, racing to the south three times faster than it had been moving previously. The fire had burned a seemingly impossible 4 miles in 20 minutes. That's a mile every 5 minutes, 5 miles per hour. That's pretty fast. Because the fire was moving downhill, the fire suddenly jumped and became a 20 to 40 foot flame fire. That's that what that guy in the airplane had seen, burning up trees as it moved downhill.
My God,
Now,
that's
stuck in
scary.
a steep-walled basin, there was no exit and they could not outrun it. Their best chance of survival lay in a depression on the basin floor where the brush or fuel was the thinnest. The Granite Mountain hotshots had less than 2 minutes to create a fire shelter deployment site. Eric radioed to the plane, "Our escape route has been cut off. The Granite Mountain hotshots are deploying their fire shelters." This involved cutting a hole in the brush, basically big enough to deploy those 19 shelters with chainsaws. The plane, who was radioing Marsh, could hear chainsaws ripping in the background as Eric was talking to him.
Ugh.
They put their chainsaws on the outside of the ring, away from the shelters, so the fuel that was in them would
Wouldn't
blow up away
bust.
from them.
Yeah.
Yeah. The rookies would have deployed their shelters first before the squad bosses, and then finally Eric would be the last one. The fire overtook the Granite Mountain hotshots at 16:42. The team was deploying fire shelters when the fire overtook them. Temperatures exceeded 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit.
And what was the temperature that those shelters could withstand? 300 degrees Fahrenheit?
300.
Oh my God.
And the site was not survivable. The 19 crew members were found dead 1 mile southeast of their last known location.
Ugh, I just got the chills and I hate this. I don't like this. That's sad.
This was like, yeah. It's just
Like
devastating. I had
knowing,
no
like,
idea like wildfires could move that quickly.
I just hope that they weren't in any pain, you know? Like, I
Yeah.
just hope it was quick enough that, like, it was hot enough that it was able to be quick enough and painless, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like, I feel like at a certain point, like, too much pain makes you go numb because it's too painful, you know?
That's very true. That is very true. Well, they do an investigation of this, and so
Oh,
we can
really?
kind of learn
Did
a
someone
little
not
bit.
put out a cigarette butt and like they're responsible for like murdering 19 people
No,
essentially?
that was the lightning strike. That's what caused the fire, but like, why
Yeah.
did this happen, basically?
Yeah.
So the fire continued down the mountain, burning over 100 homes in the Yarnell area. By the time the
Jeez.
fire was fully contained on July 10th, this is like 2 weeks after it started,
Oh my God.
it had damaged or destroyed nearly 130 buildings, injured 20 people, and killed the 19 hotshots. One of the other
Sad.
firefighters in the area, Ben Brandon, described his own team's narrow escape from this fire. He said, "On that day, all I knew was wind and fire. We were cutting a fire break. This mountain here, the fire came around on that side and came from west to east and east to west and collapsed on us in the middle. It came up through the pass here and just came on us like a fireball. I lost part of my voice box and all of my sinuses, but fortunately, through my training, I grabbed my t-shirt and got water on it and pulled it up over his like nose and mouth. If I hadn't
Yeah.
done that, they said I would have burned my lungs." His team
God.
members ran to the bottom of an arroyo, which is a steep-sided gully, and the fire went right over them, which saved their lives. He
God.
estimated that the fire reached the hotshots 90 minutes later.
That's crazy.
Yeah. So, following the disaster, the state of Arizona decided to launch an accident investigation on July 3rd, 2013, to investigate the events leading to the entrapment and deaths of 19 firefighters. Upon finding the bodies, sheriffs noted that the house that they were heading toward had not burned down and would have been survivable if they had made it.
I
Yeah.
got chills again. Oh, that's devastating.
14 of the shelters had been vaporized.
Oh my God.
Many of the men were left in the fetal position. The radios were still hissing. They were
Ugh.
somehow still functioning.
Not melted and broken.
Supposedly, they could still hear radio
That's
signals over them.
crazy.
The bodies were removed, but all other evidence was left at the scene for investigation. The team visited the site of the accident, reviewed audio and video files, and interviewed individuals associated with the incident. They also reviewed fire weather and behavior data. and examined physical evidence. The key finding in the report stated that there was an issue with communication. The team believes this is due to brief, informal, and vague radio transmission and talkarounds that can occur during wildland fire communications. However, that the immense speed and power of the fire ultimately contributed to the entrapment of the 19 hotshots. Basically, there's really no one that you can point a finger at in this situation.
It was just a really bad.
Because the crew was not at their last known location upon search and rescue, there was confusion about the crew's actual location, so it did take them a little bit to find them. Multiple memorial services were held for the firefighters, including a public memorial service that was held in Prescott Valley on July 2nd, 2013, and on July 9th, then Vice President Joe Biden spoke at a memorial service in Prescott. The deaths of the Granite Mountain Hotshot team was the greatest loss of life for the U.S. Fire Service since 9/11.
That's crazy.
That's how good we are at fighting fires now.
Oh my God.
So this was a big deal, you know. Thousands attended both memorial services, including members from over 100 hotshot crews from across the country. Granite Mountain Hotshots Memorial State Park was dedicated in 2016 to remember the fallen members. The park is a 320-acre plot of land that was the site of the Yarnell Hill fire. It features a main trail that's 3.5 miles that leads down to an observation deck that overlooks the site where the firefighters perished, and 19 steel gabion baskets. Never heard of these before, but you can see what they are. They're kind of like barriers almost. So they encircle the fatality site area with chains connecting each as a symbol of connection and teamwork of the hotshots. In 2018, the park opened the Granite Mountain Interagency Hotshot Learning and Tribute Center. The center is a one-of-a-kind wildland fire learning center that honors the legacy and of the team and motivating visitors to adopt behaviors that prevent wildland fires. So, the large lapse of communication and extreme weather conditions during the Yarnell Hill fire has led the U.S. Fire Service to reflect on issues, but has not changed a lot about how wildland fires are fought. Ultimately, no procedures or policies have been changed. But talk about improving fire shelters and equipping firefighters with GPS units have been suggested, which, like, bitch, just do it already. You know what I mean? In the case of Yarnell Hill, however, with temperatures exceeding 2,200 degrees Fahrenheit with turbulent air conditions, no fire shelter could have protected the crew.
That's crazy.
Which I'm like, just make it out of whatever you make the spaceship like. You know what I mean?
Yeah,
You
like
know,
make it
they have
more
all that like
resilient.
shiny fire retardant material. Why can't we use that? You know? The members of the team. Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, I was just gonna say, yeah, you would think that like from this learning experience, like they should take into account like, oh, the hottest that like fires that can get in this scenario is like 2,200 degrees. So we should make them resistant to 2,500 degrees, you know, something just
Or just
make.
more than 300 would be great, you know. I feel like we have that technology now. I could be
We
wrong.
gotta, we
I could be
should.
talking out of my ass, but if we can do some of the stuff we can do with AI, we could build something fire retardant enough to protect somebody from, you know what I mean? Like, yeah. So the members of the team that died were as follows: Andrew Ashcraft, Robert Cadwell, Travis Carter, Dustin DeFord, Christopher McKenzie, Eric Marsh, Grant McKee, Sean Meisner, Scott Norris, Wade Parker, John Person Jr., Anthony Rose, Jesse Steed, Joe Thurston, Travis Turbyfil, William Warnecke, Clayton Whitted, Kevin Wojcik, and Garrett Zippinger. The oldest member was 43. That was Eric. and the youngest was just 21.
That's so sad.
Only one member of the 20-man team survived, and that was Brendan McDonough, who was separated from the crew earlier that day. Investigators found that if he hadn't been picked up, he would have been the first casualty of the Yarnell Hill fire
Oh, gosh.
if he hadn't been rescued. He suffers from an immense amount of survivor's guilt and PTSD from the experience and is continuing to work through the trauma of losing his entire team.
Yeah, that's gonna take some time
I don't know how
for
you would get
sure.
over
I
that.
don't think you
Like,
ever do. I think you just get better at dealing with it. You know what I mean? I don't think you ever
yeah.
really get over it.
Yeah.
That's just, it's really sad.
It is sad. I'm sorry I did this one like right before your
Dude, and
wedding.
like at night too, like right before I go to bed, like
You're
you really know how
welcome.
to get me going, Jillian.
Yeah. Sorry. See, that's why we do happy things in Conservation Corner,
Yeah.
because we gotta bring it back
Lift the
up.
mood. Yeah, we gotta bring it back up.
Yeah. And we don't always do, but there's a reason I picked this one. I'll talk about it in a minute.
Yeah.
So we'll just sum this up. Kyle Dickman, who is the author of On the Burning Edge, which talks all about this event, he states that of wildfires, in the last 40 years, we've seen fire size increase sixfold. During that same time span, we've seen three times the average number of houses getting burned every year. There are now 140 million people living in the path of fires. So the threat of fires is real. And despite spending $4.7 billion every year, we're not seeing much evidence that the spending is doing anything to control the fire size or destructiveness. So instead of spending billions of dollars fighting them, we should be spending billions preparing for them by thinning the forest or by using more prescribed fire and by letting more wildfires burn. So, since the early 1980s, the number of large forest fires in the western US, Canada, and Alaska have been increasing, according to the Climate Science Special Report. Fire seasons are also starting earlier and ending later in the US. The number is only expected to increase as the climate warms and precipitation in these regions decreases. So,
Crazy.
that is the tragedy of the Granite Mountain hotshots. And but I hope y'all learned like how awesome these wildland firefighters are. I mean, they're putting themselves in danger
In
for months at a
yes.
time.
That's so crazy.
And just another reason that we need laws enacted to start doing something about this. I mean, it's not just the sea level rise. There's so many other aspects to this. And
Yeah.
I did this one because my dad suggested that I get a book called Fire Weather, which is not about this. It's a different story. I think there might actually be more survival in that story. So
Okay. So maybe I should read that one too.
planning on doing that one later this year, but I knew about this story. So I thought in preparation to read that book that I would
Yeah.
do this one. And I think it's an important one to do
Yeah,
just
for sure. I
because.
mean, what was it? Just last year there was that wildfire. It was either last year or 2 years ago, there was that wildfire in California that like lasted for about a month,
Yeah.
I think.
And it was apocalyptic. And then there were those
Yeah.
wildfires in Canada, like
And
in the north.
Australia.
Yeah.
Yeah,
Oh yeah,
they're
that happened before COVID, like right before
Yeah.
COVID,
Yeah, and like they
the
had to
bushfires.
rescue all of the koala bears. Like
Yeah.
all of those images of those poor koala bears having so many burns all over them. So
Yeah.
sad.
And it's a big problem. It's not just us, it's Canada, it's Australia, it's anywhere that has
Australia.
sizable dry land areas and
Yeah.
deserts.
Yeah.
Mexico, there's a lot of Middle East, I'm sure, has issues with wildfires.
Yeah.
So
It's crazy.
let me do my sources while you get ready for
Oh, for sure. The
Conservation Corner.
show.
So, what I got probably the most information from was 19, the true story of the Yarnell Hill fire from Kyle Dickman of Outside Magazine. Granite Mountain Hotshots, the firefighting team that died battling the Yarnell Hill fire, Janelle Foskett, Fire Rescue One. 19 firefighters die battling Arizona's Yarnell fire, David Greene and Ted Robbins from NPR. 2 years after Deadly Wildfire, there are lessons in the ashes. NPR staff on this day, remembering the Yarnell Hill wildfire, NOAA, National Centers for Environmental Information. 10 years later, remembering the Yarnell Hill fire and the Granite Mountain hotshots from 12 News of Arizona. I spelled it like, have you ever watched What We Do in the Shadows?
Yeah, I love that.
Right. It's like, that's how everyone talks from Tucson, Arizona. That's how I fucking spelled it. 12 News, Arizona.
Funny.
What it's like to fight fires with hands and tools, insider news, and how fighting wildfires work from Wendover Productions.
Cool, cool,
Tucson,
cool. Oh,
Arizona.
yeah, that's funny. Awesome. Well, you want to do a little conservation corner?
Yes, please. Get
Cool, cool,
me
cool.
out of fire hell.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, I decided to do the Apache trout.
Trout.
Yeah.
Woo.
I Googled endangered animals in Arizona.
Okay, you
So
know a lot
the Apache
about
trout.
trout,
Yeah.
actually.
I thought it was cool. I didn't really, I guess, realize that there was this trout species there. So it's one of only two trout native species to Arizona, and it's actually designated as Arizona's state fish. The Apache trout historically occupied streams and rivers in the upper White, Black, and Little Colorado River drainages in the White Mountains of east central Arizona. Currently, 27 pure, meaning non-hybridized, Apache trout populations exist within their historical range in, it sounds like that would be pronounced Gila or Gila. I'm gonna say
Like
Gila.
Gila
Gila,
monster.
maybe
Yeah.
Gila. Okay. So, historical range in Gila, Apache, and, Greenlee counties of Arizona on lands of the Fort Apache Indian Reservation, which is the acronym of FAIR, FAIR, and Apache Sitgreaves National Forest, which that acronym is ASNF. 13 natural populations occur on the FAIR, 3 reestablished populations occur on the FAIR, 9 reestablished populations occur in the ASNF, so that's the Apache Sitgreaves National Forest. And 2 reestablished populations occur in streams on both of the FAIR and the ASNF. 2 streams outside of historical range have pure replicate populations, North Canyon Creek and Grant Creek. North Canyon Creek received Ord Creek stock in the early 1960s. The natural population in Ord Creek was compromised by brook trout and was renovated and replaced with replicated Ord Creek stock from the ASNF and North Canyon.
They hate brook trout out there.
They do. I've told you before how I had to kill brook trout when I was in Utah.
Makes me
So
sad because brook trout are so pretty, but
they
there
are
are,
so pretty.
yeah.
But it was
What,
just
but,
because someone was like, oh, I want this pretty fish out here for fly
yeah.
fishing. So I'm going to bring it out here. And like they didn't even think about what they were doing when they brought it out there. Like, and it outcompetes the native species. And it's a problem. And what we mean by outcompete is it mean, well, in that scenario, they are born before the native species, and so by the time the brook trout get to be their size where they're eating fish as like their diet, they're eating native babies essentially, and so then like those babies aren't growing or existing. That's a problem. The Apache trout was first listed as an endangered species on March 11th, 1967, and then it was downlisted to threatened in July of 1975. And that was based on recovery actions and a reanalysis of the data. The downlisting allowed state, tribal, and federal agencies and partners to conduct management actions under the recovery plan, regulate the take of the species, and establish sport fishing opportunities. The recovery plan was completed in 1979 and then revised in 1983, and then once again in 2009. So once nearing extinction, the Apache trout has been restored to much of their historic range in the White Mountains after decades of cooperative protection and recovery efforts. And so that was from westernnativetrout.org, but then I'm also going to read a little blurb from the Arizona Game and Fish website.
Okay.
So, they were th we're talking about like the threats, because it's like, how did they near extinction? So they, what does it say up here? I'm like losing my place.
They really are super endangered because they really only have such a small range in comparison to like all the other
Yeah.
native cutthroat trout species.
And like that's the only place in the world where they're found.
Yeah, they're
So
super endemic.
yeah, they were once abundant in the White Mountains in the late 1800s. And then historic photos and accounts show early settlers harvesting hundreds of Apache trout in a single trip. So that's probably, you know, one part of the threat was they were over-harvested. In the early 1900s, state and federal wildlife agencies began stocking non-native trout species into streams and lakes of the White Mountains to increase fishing opportunities for Arizona's fast-growing population. So then that's the other threat, was they started to stock non-native trout species like the brook trout. Officials believe they were addressing the problem of overfishing in Apache trout, God damn it, Apache trout streams, and did not realize these supplemental stockings would become one of the greatest threats to Apache trout, nearly wiping them out. So the non-natives of trout that were stocked are the rainbow trout, the brook trout, the cutthroat trout, and the brown trout. And all of those species outcompete the Apache trout for limited food and cover and prey upon the young native trout. So
Yeah,
rainbow
because
and
those rivers don't really have a lot of food resources because they're so, like, mountain rivers have a lot less like organic matter in them than lower rivers do, and so they're just like less productive ecosystems on a whole.
Yeah, and then here's a fun fact. Rainbow and cutthroat trout are also genetically similar and crossbreed with the Apache trout, which compromises the genetic purity of each species.
Oh,
Which,
good.
that's an issue.
Little hybrid action.
So the White Mountain Apache tribe took the first critical steps to conserve the species in 1955 by closing fishing on the reservation waters that contained any remaining pure trout populations. Apache trout became one of the first species to be federally listed as an endangered species in 1969. And then in 1975, representatives from the Arizona Game and Fish Department, White Mountain Apache Tribe, U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, and USDA Forest Service formed the Apache Trout Recovery Team. And then the goal of that team was to develop a plan that would recover the species and ensure them the long-term survival of its species in its historical range. Early conservation work and the successful efforts of the recovery team led to the downlisting, which we talked about already, of the Apache trout in 1975 from endangered to threatened. So, yeah, angling. Let's see what this says about angling. A breeding stock of pure Apache trout is managed at the Williams Creek National Fish Hatchery, where eggs are produced, hatched, and raised to be catchable-sized trout, and the hatchery personnel stock Apache trout for recreational fishing in the Fort Apache Indian Reservation under the management of the White Mountain Apache Tribe. So it sounds like they stock the fish to be caught, which is a manageable way to control that.
Especially since at least they're native to the area, like other
Yeah.
ones. Yeah. So you worked on trout in Utah. What species did you work on when you were out there?
Well, we killed a lot of brook trout when I was there. So I used to, dude, God, it was so heartbreaking. So when it was this like summer fallish of 2017, I did like a glorified internship, you could say. It was like a stipend internship for the Utah Department of Natural Resources for their fisheries. I guess like their fisheries program out there, or like their version of a fisheries program out there. And yeah, so that we were mainly doing stock enhancement for the Colorado, not, I'm sorry, not Colorado River, the cutthroat trout, the native cutthroat trout out there. And I believe it was the Colorado River cutthroat trout. I could be wrong on that. It's been a few years, but it was a cutthroat trout species that we were doing stock enhancement on. And part of that stock enhancement meant killing a lot of brook trout. So we did that through electroshocking these streams. We did it through using rotenone in portions of these streams. And yeah, there was tiger trout out there. We went to a tiger trout hatchery. That was pretty cool to see all that going on out there, because tiger trout are a hybrid of brown trout and a brook trout. So
Okay.
that's how they make those guys.
Whoa, they're cool looking.
Yeah, they are really cool looking. And so, yeah, I mean, one part of our process, I guess you could say, was like when we were doing rote known treatments in a section of a stream, like there would be at, the top part of the stream would be where they're pouring the rote known in, and then at the bottom part there would be a buffer where they would use it. I think it was potassium something. Potassium fluoride, I think is what it was, to buffer out the rote known that they poured upstream. And then so past that buffer, I would sit, or somebody would sit, but there was one time when I would sit, and we would have one of those big gray brute trash cans with holes drilled in the side
Oh
so
my goodness.
water could
Yeah.
flow through there. And then we would take brook trout, since we didn't care if they died anyway. So we would take brook trout and like put them in those trash cans. And if I saw them start to go belly up, then I would radio up like, "Hey, you need to put more buffer in because the fish down here are dying still."
Yeah.
And the purpose of that buffer is to make sure that there's no more rote known coming through the rest of the stream. So yeah, but prior to pouring the rote known into that section of the stream, we would electroshock that section and essentially take out any fish that we were trying to not kill, and we would keep them in buckets, and then we would put them in like a fish holder or something like that while they pour the rote known in.
That's
And then we,
crazy that you could
yeah,
do that.
and then
Like,
we put the fish back in. Yeah.
that's
Yeah, so
wild.
that was cool, 'cause that was like literally in these high mountain lakes and streams in the middle of nowhere. So you like we packed horses out with all of our gear, and we would do that, and then we would just be camping in the mountains for 4 days. We worked 4 10-hour days straight, so we would pack everything up on Monday, like all of the like the big campers and everything, and like get a couple big coolers worth of food for 4 days, and then drive it up into the mountains and like literally camp up there. So we would work 10-hour days, and then we would camp up there at night. So like for 4 days straight, you literally didn't have a break from like your coworkers. So I
Jesus.
mean, you have to have a be a people person, because you also like bunked with them. Like, I mean, it was
Yeah.
that camper slept, I think, six people or eight people, and like I was the only girl on that team, which also like I feel like that's like not the greatest, like
Yeah.
I literally shared bunk beds, like a bunk bed room. Like I didn't sleep next to like a guy like that I worked with, but it was like there was a guy above me and then two guys next to me, and like the back part, like those were my coworkers, and then like my boss is a man and he is in the front like where the bed is. So I'm like, this is I feel like there's definitely some rules around this, but there's like no one cares out here, and this is just what you have to do. No, like, and you're not gonna pull another fucking camper up just for one single girl to sleep in, like with all of the rest of the gear that we're bringing up. Like, so I don't know, but yeah, it was,
An experience, I'm sure.
yeah, it was an experience for sure.
I was like, my dad is probably like so jealous of you right now when you were describing, like, yeah, we just go camp in like the mountains for 4 days. And then you said, oh, you have to really like your coworkers. And I was like, that's where you
That's where he's
lost him.
out. Yeah.
He's not a people person.
Yeah. I mean, it was nice though, because like I like camping, and like I don't know, it was nice. You did some really awesome work out there, and then you came back and you like, we had beer out there. Like you cracked a beer, you sat around a fire, we all cooked dinner together, you just talked and stargazed, and there's no cell service out there. So like, you read a book or you literally talked to people, or I don't know, just figured it out, took a walk in the woods, I don't know. But like You were around your coworkers for 4 straight days, like literally no break. And there were times when I was like, you guys are pissing me off. I need to go take a 15-minute walk. Like, just leave me alone.
Just let me be.
Like,
Oh my
because they,
God.
like, they're all guys. They would make fun of me. And I'm like, you guys can't fucking make fun of me like that. Like, I'm a girl.
I'm a little girl.
Right? Like, I'm sensitive. Stop. Oh. Like,
Well, yeah,
jeez.
and yeah, you killed a lot of brook trout, but to be fair, they're not supposed to be there in the first place. I mean, they're essentially invasive. I mean, we
Yeah.
introduced them, but
Yeah.
like
Introduced
they're,
invasives.
yeah, basically kind of like blue catfish,
Yes.
same thing.
Same thing. Same, but
Blue
different.
cats in the Chesapeake Bay. Look that up.
Yeah.
It's a shit show.
Yeah. But yeah, no, we killed a lot of brook trout. Like, it was one of those things, like, we were really trying to sample for cutthroats and stock enhance the cutthroats. But it's like, if we ever came across a brook trout, they literally would throw it up on the bank, like, chuck it
Yeah.
as far as they could to the street. Like,
Yeah. That's like with snakeheads too. Like in the East and like the Midwest, like you're just supposed to, you have to behead them because they can like live on dry land for a period of time and like go populate another river. So
Yes.
yeah. Invasive species, not good. But it
No.
seems like the like conservation efforts are working to a certain degree with the Apache trout, which is
Yeah, no,
exciting.
it's good. Yeah. I mean, they've already like decreased their threat level, which is awesome. You know. It's great.
Well, so that's a happy thing. Do we
Yeah,
want to
that is a happy
do
thing.
more happy things? Because we've really needed it. So I'm
Yeah.
so
Well,
sorry.
my happy thing is that I'm getting married next week.
That's
So
good. That's a good happy
that's,
thing.
I think that's going to be my happy thing.
Yeah. My happy thing is that I get to take a break in the Keys, and it's really needed because I have been running like a damned chicken with my head cut off for the last, I don't know, month and a
Yeah.
half, it feels like.
I hear ya.
I finished my croaker project for now. I collected my alligator guard data from the receivers. I have data to work with, and I can just take a break. And you know what? I kind of just want an office day. I just want a chill office moment
Yeah.
until I go to the Keys, and that's what I'm hoping for. And we have
Some
no
work from
plans
home.
this weekend. Zero.
That's awesome.
Except
Yeah.
we're gonna go see Dune 2 because I want to see Dune 2.
Yeah, that's awesome. I was looking at my schedule and I was like, do I actually have a weekend free? Like,
What?
what? Like, Saturday, I have nothing to do on my calendar. And then Sunday, we have like a little like girls brunch down here before the wedding.
But
So
that's
it's
nice.
nice. Yeah,
That's
no, it's nice.
sweet.
It's like Alex's, it's like the wives of Alex's friends are doing it, which is nice.
That's
So.
cute. It's happening. I'm gonna go diving next week. I'm so excited. Hopefully it won't be too
Yeah.
depressing. We
Oh my
will see.
gosh. I know. I haven't been underwater in quite some time, so I cannot tell you what it looks like out there, but it's, I mean, it's like depress, like I give the public tours and like it's like depressing having to like tell people like this is not like we are not in a good situation right here. Like, you know, last summer was really bad for us and then now we're dealing with this fish situation. And like there's still research being done to determine if this fish situation is a result of what we experienced last summer. So
Well,
it's
I
yeah.
hope our like dive instructors have the common sense to take us to some more healthy locations. We'll see.
Oh, I'm sure they would. Yeah, I'm
I
sure.
mean, I'm sure the big predatory fish and stuff are out there, and it's just, it'd be hard to see like a bleached reef, I think. But maybe that's something I need to see as a
Yeah.
biologist, you know?
I know. I was talking to my friends about like all the shit that's happening down here and they're like, "Wow, like you actually are like the first person that would see the world go to shit because like you're right there. Like it's gonna happen in the ocean first, you know? Like yeah. Yeah, we're watching it happen right now. So
Yeah,
it's
it's
pretty frightening.
all
Yeah.
around us. We're still trying to
Yeah.
distract ourselves with little happy things.
Yeah, just distract yourself with a little happy thing. Jeez.
Oh, Yeah, I
Have
guess,
you
yeah.
seen that meme where it's like, man, our parents really hit like the sweet spot of life
Right.
timeline, when they're
Yeah.
like, they'll get out right before the ocean kills us, is like the ending to that.
Yep, pretty much. They
Yeah.
didn't have to go to Nam. Well, some of them did, but
Yeah. It's like they didn't need to do that, have to do that, or most of them didn't have to do that. They got in at the right price for the housing market.
yep.
Like,
Everything was still kind of okay, ecologically speaking.
yeah, like you could afford to live. Like, that's nice.
Yep. My mom literally is texting me today and she was like, "You guys have it so tough. You have such a tough financial situation." I'm like, "We have a tough everything
Yeah,
situation.
it's
Like,
yes.
it's exhausting."
Like everybody that I know that lives where I live, like they have a second job, maybe
Yeah.
even a third job, but there's always some other way that they're getting income
Yeah,
besides like their
because you
main
have
job.
to. Yeah.
Yeah. Like I just want to work one fucking job that pays me enough money to live.
Yeah.
Like how hard is that?
Everybody's got a side hustle, or you got to have a dual income, you know?
Yeah.
You got to be a dink, dual income, no kids, just a dog.
I know. A dink G.
Dink G. All right. Well, we will be gone from doing this for a while,
Yeah.
but our listeners will be listening to the bullshit that we spew out of our mouths for the next, 3 weeks or so. So where can they find us?
You guys can find us on Mother Nature Will Kill You podcast.com. I think that's our website. I always get that confused if it's like Mother Nature Will Kill You or Mother Nature Will Kill You
It
podcast.
is,
Mother
I
Nature Will Kill You
think.
podcast. Okay.
Yeah.
Dot com. I'm gonna just
No,
check
it's
that.
podcast. It's
Okay.
podcast. Mother Nature Will Kill You podcast.com.
Yeah, you can find us on Mother Nature Will Kill You podcast.com. You can also listen to us there if you want. And then you can also find us on social media on Facebook at Mother Nature Will Kill You. And then Instagram is Mother Nature Will Kill You podcast. And then TikTok is MNWKY podcast. Yeah, we're a little all over the place in terms of naming our social medias.
We did a good job.
Yep.
It's
It's all still kind of relevant somehow. And then you can listen to us on any streaming platform like Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify. So.
Yeah. Also, if you survived a wildfire, we want to fucking hear about that shit.
Yeah.
But if you haven't, a wildfire just was maybe close to your house, or maybe if you just had an uncomfy experience in nature, maybe you saw a bear on a hiking trail, or maybe you were on a sinking John boat. It
Yeah.
doesn't have to be big. You can submit your story to either our webpage. We have a section where you can submit your survival stories, or you can submit them to our Gmail. And then, if you want to support the podcast, but you don't have any money because the world is collapsing around us and we live in a post-capitalist hellscape, might as well be a
Arguably.
post-apocalyptic hellscape at this point. We're almost there. You
Pre
can
pre-apocalyptic.
pre-apocalyptic hellscape, yeah. You can submit a 5-star review to any of our listening platforms. So
Sounds
that's
good.
so
So's that.
we'll see you in like, I don't know, like 4 weeks or something crazy like that. But
Yeah.
time is going to pass different for us than it will for
Yes,
them.
you'll hear us. We just won't be around
Yeah.
for 4 weeks.
We'll be doing other more important things.
Yes, which
No
spending quality
offense
time
to
with.
anybody who listens to the podcast, but I don't know. Haley getting married, I feel like, is pretty important.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah. I feel
I
like, yeah.
feel like that's like the one time in my life I can put myself first
I think so. I
and
think
like
so.
not feel bad about it.
Yeah, I don't think you should. I definitely don't think you should. But
Yeah.
I mean, we're still gonna be releasing content, so nobody can get mad. So shush, shush, shush,
Yes.
shush, shush.
Just hold your horses.
Just chill. All right. So with that,
Alrighty, until next time, stay safe, but most of all,
stay curious, explorers.
goodbye.
See you later.